sing this song for the healing of the world.
Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. I'm so very grateful to again have George Lakey with us here for Spirit in Action. George is many things to many people, including activist, organizer, author, professor, friend, and father. A glimpse into his 87 years of life on the planet now come to us through the documentary movie Citizen George. Today we'll delve deeply into a great many personal, professional, and spiritual aspects of George's long life of world healing work. Actually, so much so that we couldn't fit it all into only 55 minutes, so there's a full, uncut version of the interview on northernspiritradio.org with about 15 bonus minutes on topics like music, crying, failures, and more. Great thanks to Andrew Jansen for production assistance today. We'll sit now with George Lakey and an audience on the campus of Haverford College, just outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. George, alleluia to have you again on Spirit in Action. Every year or two, we've got the pleasure. So great to have you here.
So happy to do it again.
Have you had a nap every day this week at the Friends General Conference gathering?
Every day. I find it exhausting to be with so many people. My lifestyle these days as a senior is relatively solitary, which is it's happy for me because I love to write and that kind of thing. And then all these people, and a lot of them I know and I want to catch up with, and so there are these intense, wonderful conversations, and then I really need to nap.
Well, it makes absolute sense. You didn't get near as much napping in during your touring for Dancing with History.
That's right.
Maybe that convinced you to become a hermit?
And never to do a tour again. So I'm happy to do one-shots. You know, I'll go any place in the country to do a one-shot, but I'm not willing to do the intensity that's involved with the tour because it really wiped me out.
Are you 85 at the moment or 80?
86.
Turned 86. When's your birthday?
My birthday's November.
November. Could we all sing, "It makes me think of the good old days, happy birthday"? You don't know you. You sure grew out of your baby ways. Happy birthday to you. Your 86th birthday, wish many more. Health and wealth and friends by the score. Cut the cake and let's eat some more. Happy birthday to you.
Yes.
We sing that all the time at our meeting for people whose birthdays, and it's so superior to the funeral dirge that's the
happy birthday.
Okay. You're looking great, 86.
I had great genes.
Yeah? Is this all the family, everybody?
Yeah, the whole family is just, my mom and dad lived forever and all that. It was just amazing. My dad way outlived his siblings and finally got around to dying at 95. And the next day, my mom and I were talking, and she said, "I think I'm going to go for 100. And so she did. And soon after she turned 100, she decided she'd reached her goal, and it was time to die, and then that's what she did. And I was with them both when they died. And that's the kind of family I come from. You set an intention, and then you go ahead and do that.
I wanted to ask you something about that because, you know, you were raised in, at least half your family was very religious, and you definitely took a different path when you headed towards Quakers. And I know that sometimes you got feedback that wasn't positive. How was that towards the last 25 years they were around?
Oh, they mellowed considerably. They realized, you know, just watching me live and be and have a family and how things developed, that I was still in touch with God. They could see that, and they relaxed about that.
When we've had you here, George, on Spirit in Action before, you've mentioned the story, as you do in the film, you've mentioned the story about visiting Quaker meeting and then coming out and see something on the board about, oh, no, they're anti-war. And then so you spent a year trying to prove that they're wrong, right? And did your parents give you that same feedback? Because my dad, his problem with my war tax resistance, he served in the Korean War. And so it's like, what? Is this disrespecting me? Did you get that kind of thing?
Absolutely. If your dad can respond, which he did, the military draft from World War II which meant leaving his three children unprovided for and going to the military with no complaint, right? Why should you make a big deal out of that? Your dad thought it was okay. Why should you? And so, and of course, I explained it as best I could. Eventually, I was able to coax my mom into going on a peace walk from Nazareth to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And she was quite proud of herself to associate, you know, with all these peace people, mostly Quakers. So they came around. But, of course, it was a lot of deep conversation. Yeah, and definitely the issue of betrayal always hangs out, right, when there are family differences. Are you somehow letting the family down?
So aunts, uncles, cousins, did you get it from them?
Somewhat, although my aunt, who had been in the military as a WAC during World War II, she took me seriously on an intellectual level and never showed me what she really thought. But kept asking more and more questions. So it was obviously really on her mind. And she asked the questions with respect. So I thought, oh, well, that's half the game, right? She's not dismissing me. And that meant a whole lot to me. When her dad, my grandfather, died, she brought his Bible to me and said, George, I think he would have wanted you to have this. And especially I want to call attention to the fact that he had an old history of putting in his family Bible the things that were most important to him to remember in his life. And one of them was a clipping from early 1950s from the American Psychological Association that said, black people are equal with white people. And she said, your grandfather would want you, of all people, to have this clipping.
Sure. Well, we're going to talk some of this just about George Lakey, and we're going to talk some about Citizen George. Was the name chosen, by the way, specifically Citizen Kane? I mean, why Citizen George? That's not said in the movie.
Not said in the movie. I was very surprised when the film director decided that would be the name, and then immediately realized there's a sequence in the movie in which he's interviewing me in front of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. And he's asking me about my attitude toward my country, which is, of course, complicated, but includes a fierce pride in how innovative the nation's founders were. The very idea of trying to found a country without a monarch. How can you be kingless and hope to get the respect of other countries? Impossible, right? And they were willing to be extraordinarily innovative. And, of course, it's very easy to criticize the founders, and I've been part of that. But also, let's acknowledge that how many of us are really as willing to go as far away from our cultural mainstream as they did in founding their country? They were taking a very big chance. And I want to be in that spirit of innovation. So I am very proud in that sense of my country. And so the film director, meditated on that quite a lot. And he decided on his own, without checking with me, that's going to be the name of the film. This guy, for all his rebellion, for all his times in jail, is actually Citizen George.
You know, I've heard a number of times in my life, people who are concerned, that person's gay, and you're supposed to love them, but you don't love the sin, right? And we could reverse that with respect to people's attitudes towards war. They could dismiss you. Well, we love George, but this sin of his is hubris or whatever. I'm sure you've been attacked from every direction about why you've screwed up majorly in thinking that pacifism is. But you did the work in that year after you thought about it to find it. Has God spoken to you about it directly? I mean, I've had like 5 or 6 times in my life where I've actually heard from God, got a message, very clear, direct. Did you get that kind of thing, or is it just researching and, reading your Bible? I don't know how you arrived at it.
I think God's role in my coming to that was making me troubled until I came to it. Because I started out that year of investigation wanting to prove that my dad was right to go into the war, and I wanted to prove that for myself. However, I was troubled about war, deeply troubled about war. And so I kept researching, thinking, probing, praying, and God kept me troubled about that question. I mean, it was almost an obsession. It was in my college years when I could afford to do well in courses and still have an obsession. And so I was obsessively trying to come to terms with it. And the conclusion was pacifist conviction. And then I stopped being troubled. So thank you, God.
It appears to me that you haven't given up praying. And some people kind of assume, you know, you get past that youthful indoctrination and you still pray. Tell me about your religious life. How does this compare to 20 years ago, to 40 years ago? You're 86 now. How does it compare to that point when you discovered Quakers? Do you pray less, more, differently?
I think I pray less because I'm one of those very conventional people who tends to pray most in emergency, in situations where I'm not confident that I can handle something by myself. So sending for the reinforcements in a way. So I'm not proud of that. I've read about the lives of people for whom prayer is a kind of happening thing in their daily life. And that's not true for me, although I often go there. But I especially always go there when there's something going on in my life that's challenging and that I don't know how to handle or am not confident that I know how to handle. Maybe I do, but I feel fear. That's what I also suggest to other people. You might say it's totally appropriate in this day and age for us to feel a lot of fear about where our country's going. And maybe if you're not fearful, you don't know what's going on. And so I'm fearful frequently, as I read the newspaper pretty much every day. I must say that it does worlds for my prayer life.
Perfectly said. Perfectly said, George. You tell in the movie your experience at 12, you're going to be a great child minister, you're going to be out there getting it, and they turned you down, right? Because addressing racism was too much of a stretch.
Showed how out of touch I was.
Right. Are you happy they turned you down?
Oh, yes.
At the time, I imagine you were fairly crushed.
I was crushed because I was so proud. I knew my mom would be totally thrilled to be the mom of a minister because her devotion to the church was far greater than my dad's. My dad also had a lot of cynicism about the church, whereas she was like, you know, all the way. And so she would have been so proud. And of course, I wanted my mom to be proud of me. And also, I just thought it would be a total hoot to be able to be there, you know, giving sermons and stuff like that. And the time that they gave me that chance to give a sermon, I really worked hard for it and I prayed on it. And I gave this sermon that in my 12-year-old's eyes, I thought was really good and was an airtight case for why racism is wrong and racial equality is what we should all be working for. And of course, I was not reading my own congregation at all. You know, I was just completely out of sync with where people were. But I was 12 years old. That was the best I could do. And so I was so pleased with that. And then to be basically told by the church elders, don't call us, we'll call you. Forget that, little boy. It really hurt my feelings. I also knew it was about feelings rather than about what God really had in mind for me. You know, after I got over the initial hurt, I realized, oh, George, you know, you're only 12, and give yourself a break. Who knows what God really has in mind for you, and maybe it's not this. So relax.
In watching the movie, Citizen George, I became aware, because I've read your books, I've talked to you many times, there's a gap between that 12-year-old and when you find your ministry, when you first connect with Quakers. That happens in the Bible with Jesus. 12-year-old, right? He's got that. The elders there are respecting him, and his parents yank him away and said, no, it's not time for you. What happened for you? Because we all theorize that Jesus went off to India or somewhere and became, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of theories about what happened in those intervening years, because it's not till he's 30 that we hear from him again. What happened religiously for George before going to Quaker meeting, but after that 12-year-old disappointment?
Well, of course, when I went to college, I went through a period of big doubt about the whole thing. I think that's probably required. At least many college students go through that. On the other hand, I was still aware that there was a part of me that was hungry for religious support, spiritual support. So I made the round of churches in my college town, thinking, well, I'm a curious guy, so this is a great opportunity.
Curious George, are you saying?
Curious George, there we go. I admit it. And so why not find out? What are the Baptists up to? What do the Methodists do? What do the Lutherans do? What do the Catholics do? So I gave myself a great old time, really, going from church to church to church on the different Sundays. And that's why I went to Quaker Meeting. It was just on my list. I had no particular interest in Quakerism. I didn't even know anything about Quakerism. It was on the list, so I went. And there was this, of course, as I describe in my book, a very big aha moment. It was like, whoa, these people are really different. And what do I make of this? And there was something going on during worship that was so different from the other places and really touched my soul. And I thought, these people have something, and it's very mysterious what they have. So I think I want to check it out. But then on the way out, as you know, I saw on the bulletin board that Quakers were pacifists. They should be working against the military draft. And I thought, oh, everybody's got their problem. Nobody's perfect. And so that's their problem. They're not willing to live in the real world. Come on, but maybe I'll give them a second chance. So here's this, 18-year-old being generous.
Just as you always are.
Giving Quakers a second, as if Quakers are sitting around hoping that I'll give them a second chance. But anyway, that's what I did, and I gave them many, many chances, and I'm so grateful.
You must have been a fairly eloquent speaker at the age of 12. In order to be invited. You've obviously kept that ability as you went forward. For me, I got in debate and forensics when I was 15, and that helped step me up. But it was at 18 where I said, I better check out what these other religions have. I grew up Catholic. And I just happened to be fortunate that a friend was Quaker, so I found these people are really different. And we found that. I still think there must have been times when people told you that they were trying to elder you in Quaker Meeting, like, George, don't you think maybe you're good, peace-loving, and you have a laughing personality. Did that always keep them from attacking you and telling you to sit down, George?
Well, I was very reluctant to speak during meeting. Vocal ministry came late, actually. But then I made up for it during coffee hour. So, yeah, I needed to mature quite a lot before I risked, I don't even remember the first time somebody said, why don't you speak at our first day school, in a few Sundays and share about X, whatever it would have been. And I felt very like an apprentice to Quakers. I really felt like they have something so different from everything else that I know about. I felt very humble. Very, very humble, which if my parents only knew that there was at least one moment in my life when I felt humble.
There's a sign I saw at a gas station where I live, and it says something like, 17-year-olds, move out, rent your own house, feed yourself, do your own job, do all that while you still know everything.
Exactly. That wasn't me around religion. It was about everything else. It was a pain in the neck in many respects. But I definitely, with regard to spiritual stuff, I was very curious about mysticism. I was reading Aldous Huxley and his approach to mysticism and other writers and actual mystics. So it was a big search thing. And I think part of the attraction, frankly, of Quakerism was it seemed like a religion where you weren't on the defensive if you were searching. And I often heard the word seeker used in a very positive way. And I didn't know any other religious tradition in which seeker was regarded as a positive thing. It was always seek, but fine, pretty quick. How about by next Sunday? And so it was just right for me, for my particular personality, to associate with people for whom seeking was okay. I could take my time. I could seek.
I think many people over the last 50 years that I've been involved with Quakers, that they came to Quakers because Quakers were doing good political things, racial equality or anti-war or on and on, environmental and so on. For you, I sense it was very different. You came for the spiritual reason in that. But somehow, you have become this force. Every Quaker I know knows of George Lakey and knows of the training you've done, the incredible way, Vietnam or civil rights or equality in so many ways. You've spearheaded so much of that. How did you get there? Because, you did the reading about military and said, okay, yeah, pacifism, that is what God wants, right? Mm-hmm. You must then have had mentors who said, here's the next step or here's where you might want to go.
Very important. very important. There was a couple in my first meeting, High Street meeting in Westchester, the Arvios, Ray and Cynthia Arvio, who took me under their wing, realized here's this questing college student, and they wanted to be open to questing college students. And so they would have me over for dinner and that kind of thing. And I would say, hey, can I bring my friends sometime over to meet you? And they said, yeah, sure, why not? And so I'd bring, you know, 4 or 6 people over, and we'd have and we'd have an evening talking about this or that. And they were always so brilliant and thoughtful and willing to be kind of, you know, meeting us on our level, but with such a world of understanding that we didn't share. And so, wow, that was fun. Could I come again and bring my friends? Sure. So the next time, 12 of my friends show up.
And you know, that's what you get for having so many friends. They gave rise.
So, yeah, so it went like that. They became kind of, you know, my new spiritual foster parents over time. And they introduced me to a range of people. At one point, Ray took me aside and said, look, I just want you to know Bayard Rustin is coming to town. You've heard a lot about Bayard Rustin. I know you want to go and sit at his feet and stuff because he's amazing, amazing, amazing. And if he's here long enough, he may get to know you some, but he'll be very busy. So don't hound him. But if he does take notice of you and gives you some of his time, it is conceivable that he would ask you to sleep with him. And I just want you to know it is okay to say no. And that doesn't mean that he won't, you know, next time you run into him, be very open and
You mean because he was gay?
Because he was gay. Yeah. Right. Yeah, right. So that was the way my...
And wait a minute. I'm surprised at that point that that family is comfortable with it. Quakerism was still rudimentary in terms of its full embrace of sexual diversity. But they were.
They were, yeah. Yeah, they were fine if I wanted to go to bed with Bayard, but they didn't know what my sexuality was, and I was very unsure about what my sexuality was. And there's no way I would have said yes, actually, anyway, just because it'd be too, I mean, there wouldn't be enough context for me to say yes. But anyway, so that's an example of the kind of mentoring that I got. It was rounded. It was holistic mentoring rather than only about spiritual issues, not that that's to be minimized, but... I was this questing guy who's very, very different now from what his parents expected, discovering this whole big world, and had wonderful people who were willing, endless patience. When I think back, I can't believe they were so patient with me.
I can't let this go, though, because you mentioned Bayard Rustin, and I figured, I mean, of course, I know about him now, and it's over the last 50 years, it's become more open. A lot of people kind of hit him to the back, and that's why he couldn't have a more prominent role in the 1963 March on Washington, right? He was a risky figure because he was gay and Quaker. Quaker wasn't a negative thing in that setting.
No, but the gayness was a big problem.
Yeah. So what year are we talking about when he was coming to town that they would have been saying this to you? About when would that have been on the calendar?
58.
So this is way back there. And so my sense is that most of us have heard of Bayard Rustin now, but I'm not even sure Quakers at that time he was that prominent of a figure, or in political circles was he his name that big? Because they were expecting you were going to go gaga, which I can understand why you would, but
right.
I just didn't know that it was out there in the world that much.
It wasn't, but among Quakers, and any Quakers who felt strongly about peace and racial concerns and economic concerns would know of Bayard. Because he was very visible around the country. He'd been to, I don't know how many friends meetings, speaking, and that kind of thing. Local Quakers would often get him a speaking engagement at the local university, that kind of thing. He was a very amazing stamina as a traveler speaker, working for Fellowship for Reconciliation, speaking coast to coast. I don't know how many states. He seemed tireless. So there were a lot of the kind of Quakers who are really plugged in to how do we advance Quaker testimonies without necessarily putting the stamp Quaker on it, felt like Bayard was a godsend. Let's get Bayard to young people in our area. So they were very tuned into that. But on the other hand, they felt protective because of his willingness to just, pick up somebody without really knowing them.
And these days it would be so much looser, more available, or easier to have less fear, because I think I was raised being, I'm supposed to be afraid of queers, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was too. We all were. Yeah,
right.
We all were.
It's,
absolutely.
It's that epic. Yeah,
yeah, but these were very advanced. I don't know. They could be called Bohemian, maybe, or something. Yeah. Tuned into Greenwich Village and all that.
Okay. Hey, folks, we're speaking with George Lakey here today. We happen to be at Haverford College here in Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. And we have a room full of people with it. Could you make some noise, folks? And we're speaking with George Lakey, and just recently they've released the world premiere for the movie Citizen George. Happened on Monday night, I think, here. I saw it just a couple days previously. But that's only one of the things about George Lakey you want to check out. There's so many books. I've interviewed him about dancing through history and Viking economics and many more books that he's written. So you want to track them down. Where's the best place to go for the movie?
The website. So try I wonder what it's called. Citizen George. So it's find a website that includes the word Citizen George.
And I'll include this on my website, which is, of course, northernspiritradio.org. We'll have all the links, and I'll include with this interview, I'll include links to the past interviews I've had with George Lakey, so you can listen to all of them. There's threads of important changes to the world and spiritual insights and just excitement that George always carries with him. And I do that, of course, for all of my guests. For the last 19 years, I've been doing Northern Spirit Radio. Again, northernspiritradio.org. Visit, post a comment, give me suggestions. I need your help to know where I should be talking to people about what issues. Send people my way. Help me connect. And so post a comment when you come. You can also donate. This is full-time work that is supported by your donations, not by government and not by corporations. This is a very conscious decision we've made not to base ourselves on the whims of corporations. Even those people who don't have a specific quid pro quo about it still will expect you to do things a certain way on your programs if you're getting paid by a corporation. So please support me so I don't have to go begging to them, because I won't. And then we'll just have to shut down. Sustainability happens when we work together. I wanted to talk to you, George, a little bit about, well, there's so many wonderful things in your life. We've talked about them in previous interviews. Certainly, your trip on the Phoenix is one of them. Can you give me a highlight, something I don't know? I want you to stretch. And you've got to remember every time you've talked to me and everything you've written. Something I don't know about that trip. How many changes of clothes did you take with you?
Very few, because I must say, when you're in the Pacific Ocean on a little sailboat with, you know, eight comrades of yours, you don't really need to dress up.
But you might get sunburned. Is one of the issues. No,
well, that's what we all expected, to get sunburned. Yeah, we got plenty sunburned.
When I went in the Peace Corps, they had a limit. You could take 80 pounds of stuff with you. And I'm going to live for 2 years in Africa, right? 80 pounds of stuff. So I took only 65 pounds of stuff plus my guitar. I had to have that. I don't think you took a piano. Did you take any other instrument with you? Was there music on this trip?
Oh, there's definitely a guitar. Fortunately, John Braxton brought his guitar. He was on the crew as well. And so we did a lot of, you know, when we had the time, we could just sit around on the deck and sing and sing and sing. Had a wonderful time.
So there's civil rights work that you were involved in, including child minister, trying to get them to straighten out about that. You've certainly Vietnam War stuff. And then following the Vietnam War, you get into many more issues. I think you're thinking more structurally about American society. Therefore, movement for a new society is born, right? The 1960s were supposed to be about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I'm not sure you covered all three of them well enough.
I left drugs out.
Completely?
Completely.
And drinking?
Well, occasionally I would have a drink, sort of a social drink. When I got interested in developing my gay sexuality, exploring that, the place to go in Philadelphia, I was, you know, my college was outside Philadelphia, not far. So I could go into Philadelphia and go to gay bars in order to find gay men and learn about myself. And I wasn't looking for a long-term relationship. I was looking to, basically, I was a pretty selfish boy, and I was just trying to find out, who am I? Anyway, the place to meet guys was in a gay bar, and you can't really hang out for 2 hours in a gay bar without drinking something. So, you know, I would drink beer or gin and tonic or something while I was waiting for somebody to take me home.
Mm-hmm. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. So you got music, rock and roll too?
No, I never got interested in rock and roll. I was so happy with classical and popular, Broadway. I was nuts about Broadway. There was another attraction of gay bars. Some of the gay bars really featured like a piano player who would play Broadway tunes. And I love that, sing hours and hours around the piano. So what do? At French General Conference? I play the piano for show tunes. Yeah, absolutely. I feel very fortunate that I can do that.
In the movie Citizen George, you talk about your experience more explicitly than I'd read about it before in Dancing with History and so on, about your experience of coming out before the Friends General Conference plenary. You know, you're speaking. Everybody recognizes you as a political activist, you know, anti-war, racial equality, all these wonderful things you've done. And then you say, I sleep with men. Or I don't know exactly which words you used, but I'm sure it was a shock for them.
Profound shock. Within a week, Japanese Quakers had heard about it. It was a profound shock.
Did Bayard Rustin soften the blow against you because he had already been?
No. He wasn't known yet. He hadn't come out to Quakers yet. I mean, it was like privileged information that would be passed along among by some people, but he wasn't out. No, he wasn't out. No, almost nobody was out. It was a crisis of integrity for me. I was a little bit in touch with the incipient gay movement that was just beginning to start. But basically, the integrity question for me was that I was widely accepted and well used by Quakers as a spokesperson, leader, so on, with the understanding that here was this wonderful family man. Because I had a wonderful family. I had a fantastic Norwegian wife who was very pretty and very articulate herself and very bright and very amazing. And we had children. We had two black children and a white child. We'd adopted two children, and then we created one of our own, who became a Quaker happily, named Ingrid. And she's an amazing leader in her own right now. But anyway, so picture looking at this family, given Quaker values, right? So you have this Quaker family that's like on the cutting edge of Quakerism, and they've got this interracial family, right? These two cute black kids, and then this cute little baby with red hair, and aww. So that was the attitude of the Society of Friends, as far as I could make out at the time. Society, nationally, I was a national figure at that time already. And it was basically a collective, aww, about the Lakeys. And I recognized that it's fraudulent. Because if they knew that I'm a gay man, I mean a bisexual man, whatever you call me, and that I did have a gay lover, I would not get a big, aww.
You get an.
Exactly. The response would be entirely different. It'd be upside down. And so I felt like a fraud. And it didn't stop me from doing quality work, but it was eating me. And I, of course, if we can't do personal integrity, then where are we? And Barrett was very in on this inner struggle. And we talked and talked and talked about it. What would be the consequences? Well, you know, it'll shut down a lot of opportunities, George, that you've got. And on the other hand, you have to be in your own integrity. In some way, I know I saw, there are things I don't say to some of my friends because I don't think it's wise for them to know about you, you know, so I don't want to out you and stuff like that. In some ways, it would simplify everything if we just came out, but also, of course, it would enormously complicate our lives, but in a different way. So if you're ready to do that, George, it's okay. What precipitated the decision was that Friends General Conference invited me to keynote the gathering at Ithaca, New York, for the national thing. So we'd have 1,000 Quakers. In those days, it was whatever, 1,200, very, very big gatherings right there in the auditorium, and we could come out all at once.
You laugh, but I think there was crying going on.
Oh, it was so scary. And so we made the decision probably 10 months before the act, and those were 10 months of meeting with friends, trusted friends, crying, screaming, stomping my feet, beating pillows, just going through an incredible interior emotional thing composed basically of fear, to get the courage to be able to follow through. We didn't tell anyone we were going to do this, except a very, very few intimate Quaker friends who were involved with a community of ours that we were doing, Utopian Community. And we were confiding with them partly so that they would support us at FGC gathering, and that they would listen to us because Barrett got tired of me beating up on pillows in front of her. And so, so they were willing to let me beat up pillows in front of them and that kind of thing. So I did an enormous lot of emotional work, a lot of shaking, shivering, you know, with fear, shedding the fear, until we finally were in a shape to do it. So, okay, so we were invited to speak on community. Because we were leaders of this amazing intentional community.
You and Barrett?
And me together. Oh, yeah, the invitation was to both because we were leaders of an intentional community that had gathered a lot of interest, including from the New York Times. Our topic was community. And so Barrett spoke first, tremendously eloquent, clear, articulate, amazing. And I followed. That's what we planned. And then I said a whole bunch of stuff and waiting till the end of my talk to come out. And then I said, and one of the things I said that builds community is people being honest with each other, because it really supports the strength of a community when people are candid with each other and what our particular struggles are or whatever. And so I could give you an example right now of what that frank candidness would be like. So I could tell you that the fact, which is a fact, that I am a gay man, I'm bisexual, I can love men as well as women. Thank you very much. And I sat down. So because I knew it, there wasn't nothing I could say after that. So I just leave it till the end, right? So I sat down. Well, the place is like this collective gasp. And then we go into the silence that's customary after speakers speak in those kinds of huge meetings. So there was this long silence in which we're sitting there soaking our clothes with sweat. And then the MC, the clerk of the evening says, thank you, friends. Thank you, Lickies. Have a good evening. So so everybody shakes hands, you know, as they do. And leaves. And the custom in those days was that the speakers would come down off the platform, stand right in front of the platform, so that and people would, like, create a line and come and thanks very much. You know, there's a lot of handshaking. Oh, thank you so much for your evening contribution, da-da-da. So we did the customary thing, knowing. And the line was enormous. You know, there were people with tears in their eyes still because they burst into tears when I made that statement. And coming up, and then Barrett and I had to respond to the very different reactions that friends were having. So some friends were throwing themselves into our arms. Thank you so much. Oh, my God. At last it's been said. And other friends were so hostile. And there were a couple of guys I thought were going to slug me. And we needed to be ready, so angry, because it was like a total attack, you know, on what they understood to be right. And I understood that this would happen, but the actual experience of trying to be ready and available to each person coming at us from whatever place they were coming at, it was the most strenuous spiritual exercise of my life. But our friends who were in on this from the beginning were sitting in the very front row. They had gotten the early sitting in the very front row. So they had been sitting there, like, radiating love to us the entire time that we were speaking. And they were sitting there then radiating love and holding my youngest, my baby Ingrid. And at some point, they thought, George and Barrett can't handle much more. This is beyond endurance. And so they jumped up and said, thanks very much, Barrett and George. You've been wonderful. Thanks. We're running away with you. And they grabbed us and ran us out of the auditorium and ran us downtown to the ice cream store.
It cures many problems. Yeah.
And I do describe this in my book, Dancing with History. It was one of the most amazing parts of the book to write. And there we sit, you know, in a round table laughing and just like letting go of all this tension and fear and concern and what about the future and so on. And, sitting there with our kids because somebody was had to take care of the kids. And I had Ingrid on my lap, you know, and she had no idea what was going on. She just knew we were all having a good time.
I was wondering if this actually, you felt like in the aftermath, this undercut or maybe enhanced your ministries, both, I'm talking about Movement for a New Society and other activism you're doing. did this end up strengthening that or undercutting? Because so many people have the fear is if you do this kind of thing, you're going to scare everyone away. Just, you know, keep that quiet. Because as a matter of fact, in 1976, I was at college and during Black History Month, went to the Black Student Union. And there was a video and such. I was there with my friend Darlene, who's black. And she said, in the movie, they talk about how we have to unite and all this so that black men get strong. And she is a strong feminist type. And she says, what about women? And the guy said, well, we understand that's really necessary. But what we have to do is get the men up, and then they can help the women up. And she wasn't having it. But it's not unusual to say, no, you don't fight different battles at different times. So did you lose much support?
Oh, sure. Doors closed. A lot of doors closed.
Like what?
Oh, I don't even remember. I think I consciously forgot, to tell you the truth. Okay. You know, things that I would have been invited. I'd hear secondhand, you know, around the corner that something or other that I was, the plan of that institution was to invite me to do this, that, the other thing, and decided, no, George is too hot to touch. So there were a bunch of doors that closed in that way. And on the other hand, there were opportunities that opened, you know, because there were people who, oh, I could raise that question with George, you know, or, oh, and all the people who were just in love with truth said, whoa, we've been given a gift. And so there was quite a range, you know, from big hostility to big love. And we did it in order to get out of the lie we were living. And that was number one. That was essential, because living a lie, oh my God. But on the other hand, it ended up, I think, enhancing my ministry. I think it just made everything much more real.
One of the great disappointments from my point of view is that Movement for New Society ended. It had a good run. Now, I don't know how many intentional communities along the way, born out of political activism, thrive for a short period and then were undercut. I think of The Farm in Tennessee, a wonderful, inspirational place, and still with remnants there that are pretty great as it is. So Movement for a New Society ending. When people talk about we should have this kind of a community do something, I say, what wisdom do you draw on from previous organizations, communities that have lasted for hundreds of years? So, you know, 20 years, not bad, but 1,000 years, that's pretty impressive. So I was disappointed that Movement for a New Society ended. You don't evidently take it as a failure. You take it as another learning experience, I imagine. But there still must have been some sadness in it for you, at least.
Yeah. There needed to be a lot of grieving in the process. Yeah, I led the process of laying it down because I had led the process of creating it. So I felt that responsibility. You know, somebody founding something needs to feel at least some responsibility for how's it going. And so I was always not only a participant, but also looking with that eye of how's it going. And my question of how's it going basically was, how well is it performing its mission? Because it was never only a community for us in the community. It was always to advance the nonviolent revolution externally, to give us a base that would enable us to be stronger and more powerful in building people's organizations, in building movement groups, in building da-da-da-da-da. And we were amazing for almost 2 decades in that way. And there were a lot of great things that happened that nobody knew Movement for New Society was part of, because we were, you know, it was useful to be subtle about that and to be, but really building, making great things happen. So that was our success. That was our satisfaction. And our ability to do that mission was fraying, getting less and less.
Why? That's the thing I don't understand. Why? Because I think you conceived it and lived it out beautifully. I know a number of people who were part of Movement for New Society. Why didn't it work? And I think there's some crucial understanding I want to garner from that, because I want us to have that perfect success. Maybe you don't have the answer right now, but what was it that, why did it fray?
Well, one element of that was that we got caught by a larger cultural trend in society that I didn't see coming, didn't know was going to come. And that larger trend was an anti-leadership impulse. Question leadership. Always wonder, you know.
Question authority.
Question authority. There we go. That would be the, right, with a button, right? Okay. Complete with a button. So more and more of the people who joined Movement for the New Society brought that cultural, new cultural impulse with them, that question authority thing. Well, there was, of course, an authority structure holding that community together and keeping it on its mission. I was one part of that. There were a number. There were many, many, many of us who had started it or joined, you know, along the way and brought a lot of expertise and know-how and stuff like that to build it and keep it running and extend it and make it even more amazing. But however, we're within the community regarded as authoritative, especially by newbies, because when they arrived, you know, who seemed to get the most respect when they talked? You know, it's easy to find when you look at a group. Oh, well, you know, everybody listens to that person. You know, well, that must be a leader, right? So I was one of those, but there were a number of others who were regarded. So the anti-leadership, you know, so where are you coming from? You know, why do people pay attention? They don't pay attention to me. Well, you're 17 and you're whatever. You know, you have not done what this 30-year-old did or whatever. So that undermined and made it actually impossible. It got so out of control, this constant conflict within between people who had their eye on the original mission and had been successful at being continually undermined by people who were worried about that condition in power terms. Some of us tried camouflaging and trying dodging and were really voices under the table. Or, you know, we try all these different, and of course, making friends with the new people and offering ourselves as mentors. And a bunch of the young people were not coming in looking for mentors. They didn't think they had anything to learn from anybody over 30. In fact, wasn't there a movement-wide expression?
Don't trust anybody over 30.
Right. Well, naturally, the founders of a 20-year-old organization, you're going to have some 30-year-old there. Or maybe even 40-year-olds, or, oh, heaven forbid, 45-year-olds. So, so that dynamic was degrading the quality to the point where we were not doing our job, in my opinion. So, and I was not the only one. I mean, it was just eroding. You could really see it. So I thought, well, since I was the main founder, I should be the main destroyer. You can tell I have this response.
I'm not sure I know the logic on that one, well, but I can understand
and
why.
And you could say, you know, George, you're a runaway, you know, responsibility freak or something. You know, you always see responsibility on yourself, wherever, whatever the situation is. And probably I am. Anyway, I tend to look at something, and if I had something to do with it getting to be the way it is, I really feel this tremendous obligation to do something about it. So I was the primary person persuading a sufficient number of people that we had lived a fine an honorable life. We had made an amazing contribution, and it was time to let it go.
I think that societal trend led to the downfall of the farm as well. You know, you've got your charismatic person coming, leading people over from California there, and then people are, we don't want to have a leader. We don't want to trust someone. We're all on our own. You seem to me, and I haven't lived side by side in the house with you, so I haven't seen you on your bad days maybe, but you seem to be very charismatic without being egotistical. I don't know if that makes sense to you. Have you had to fight ego in yourself? Hey, I'm the great leader. I've done all these wonderful peace and justice and everything actions. Did you have to confront that in you, or maybe other people confronted you?
Both. I checked myself a tremendous lot. I'm doing it this week. I checked myself a tremendous lot because I'm really blessed by Quakerism, I think. I mean, I've been brought up in a church where, you know, a charismatic preacher is just totally lauded and can run the church and all that. So it was a Society of Friends devotion to egalitarianism and the things that we love that persuaded me, convinced me, converted me, maybe. And you don't really want the overseers in your house every other week saying, come on. So we do take a lot of responsibility, I think, we Quakers, to check ourselves. How did I do in that meeting and stuff like that? So that became a habit for me, thanks to Quakers. And so I do that routinely, and I do that here. I do it today. And so that was part of it. Also, we had the old hands in the group were very trusting in each other. So we would also give feedback to each other. Somebody would be listening to one of the newer, younger people complaining about another one of us, you know, and then bring that word and say, you know, and I wonder if you were heavy-handed with regard to this or that, or this or that. So we were not impervious. It was the reverse, very sensitive to what was going on and our role in it. Of course, adjusting constantly because wanting the organization to continue. On the other hand, we had to achieve consensus because consensus was this huge, almost God,
When you decide things in unity, it changes so much in terms of what ego does in a group.
So we had to achieve consensus to lay ourselves down. And there were people predicting to me, George, you will never get consensus to lay this thing down. There are too many people with a real stake in it, including you. But it seems like you're trying to figure out how to get it laid down, and you'll never succeed. So that's one of my successes that I can't write about. Which is that I was successful in laying down this amazing gift to American social change.
I'd like to end with one, I think, success story, EQUATE, EQAT, the Earthquaker Action Teams. And just yesterday, there was an EQUATE action that people left here, the Friends General Conference and gathering, where George Lakey and 1,100 other people are here, right by Philadelphia. And there was an action. A number of people went off. What I want to know is, did you miss your nap?
I missed my nap. And you know what made up for it?
What?
I got to walk on that walk with two different babies of friends of mine who had brought their babies to Friends General Conference. And one at a time, one I got to cuddle while we were waiting for speakers to talk, and the other one I got to march along our march holding this baby. And that made the whole day very sweet.
In the movie Citizen George, besides your face, the other face I think we see and voice we hear most often is that of your daughter, Ingrid. Wonderful person, and I've interviewed her. So if you go to NordenSpiritRadio.org and search Ingrid Lakey, you will also find her being interviewed. So she was involved in this. The two of you were part of the beginning of EQUATE, more than 10 years ago, 12 years ago? I'm not sure exactly. Do you feel like EQUATE has been a success in each of its campaigns? Of course, you eventually got PNC out of financing Mountaintop.
Was that ever a victory?
Yes.
Whoa.
So
in 5 years, we did it in 5 years. When some of my distant friends found out about starting that campaign, they called me and said, George, now you've really lost it. You're out
they
of your
couldn't
mind.
Believe that you
They
did.
Couldn't believe that we would embark on such an impossible thing. The group started in my living room. How does a living room group take on
the big money? Ooh.
The big money. So it was a very sweet victory.
In the course of that, the thing that I love the most is PNC, they decide, they're all here in Pennsylvania. We're going to move down to Florida to have this. And so they won't be able to stop our shareholders meetings, and they won't even that. And then you got all the connections down there, and oops, cut off one head and another one of the Quaker Hydra pops up.
Exactly. Yeah. They didn't know the Southeastern Yearly Meeting existed. They're Florida Quakers delighted to join this action.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Campaign. And there's been more efforts by EQUATE. It didn't stop just with ending with PNC.
Oh, no. We always want to take on another fossil fuel climate destroyer because there are plenty of them. And we're being asked this time by an international coalition that's been watching us and already had decided to go after Vanguard, which is arguably the largest investor in fossil fuels. So there's Vanguard, which is, of course, famous for taking care of old people. That's what its mission is, presumably. But on the other hand, delights to destroy the future of the grandchildren of the grandparents that they're supporting, right? So the contradiction is enormous, and that's yummy. Whenever there's a really big contradiction in social change terms, that's a yummy situation. So we said yes to the international coalition. So Vanguard is way too big for us, but because we're part of many, the specific reason they wanted us was because we're strong in the area where Vanguard's headquarters is. So we lead the charge with regard to direct action and the headquarters.
It's beautiful, beautiful work. There are so many websites that I want to direct people to, but keep in mind that the reason that got us here today is the release of the movie about George Lakey. It's really a broad view of a wonderful, fruitful life called Citizen George. I'll have a link for that on NordenSpiritRadio.org. We'll have links to Equate and to other actions. There's so much out there. All of the books you want to read, Dancing with History and Viking Economics and everything else, anything he writes comes from his pen is gold. So thank you so much for doing that lifeline of work. There's finally a movie that I can sit down and be proud to watch instead of figuring I wasted my time. So, folks, please do check out the movie, Citizen George. Thanks so much, George, for joining me.
Thanks for asking me.
And thank you, all of you in the room here.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
We'll see you all next week for Spirit in Action.
The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.